Hey, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, the 2016 election highlighted a number of political divisions within the United States. Perhaps most starkly, the fault line that runs between the urban and rural regions of the country. It also drew people's attention to another phenomenon, the fact that Democrats often receive more votes but lose elections. In a new book, political scientist Jonathan Rodin traces the history of this geographical split and explores the profound consequences for politics in the U.S. His book is titled, Why Cities Lose: The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. Jonathan Rodin, your book talks about the geography of this country and why it matters so much in our political divide. So when do you think all of what you've seen actually began?
Well, we can find examples of urban-rural discord going all the way back to Hamilton and Jefferson. But the current divide, I think, has its roots in the industrial era, the era of heavy industry in the early 1900s and the late 1800s, and the rise of manufacturing in big cities, and then the emergence of labor unions, and then an alliance that eventually formed in the 30s between those labor unions and the Democratic Party in the New Deal era. And that's really when the Democrats started to become a more urban party. Before that, they had actually been more rural in many parts of the country. And then that started a process where the Democratic Party became increasingly urban and the Republican Party became increasingly rural in the decades since then.
So explain the challenges facing Democrats. I mean, how many times have the Democrats lost the Senate, and talk about why that is?
Well, right. I think everyone knows that we have this unique upper chamber of our legislature that came from a deal struck when the Constitution was being negotiated to give equal representation to all the states, regardless of size. At that time, it was small places like Rhode Island that benefited, but eventually we've done things like split the Dakota Territory into two states that have four senators. We've added a lot of sparsely populated states in the West and ended up with an institution that really remarkably overrepresents rural areas. And I think people are well aware of that. But the story about what happens in Congress or in state legislatures is a bit less well known.
What is it that's happened that's put Democrats at such disadvantage here?
You know, we have a system of representation in which we draw single-member districts at the level of state legislatures and in Congress, where there's a winner-take-all district. And when we draw those in a context where one party is highly concentrated in cities, it makes it hard for that party to translate its votes into seats. We end up with a party of cities that runs up very large majorities in the urban districts and then ends up having its reputation and kind of people who one sees on TV, the kind of people who one hears speaking for the party, tend to also be from cities. And that makes it hard for the party to then make itself appealing often in the really pivotal districts in the suburbs that are necessary to win legislative majorities. You know, they're trying to achieve many goals at the same time, win presidential elections, but also try to win a Senate majority and also try to win a majority in the legislature. And trying to do all those things at once turns out to be quite complicated because the voter that you're trying to reach for each of those institutions, because of the geography, is a very different kind of voter with very different ideas. So the party has to be many things to many people at the same time. So this is a problem that it turns out parties of the left in systems like the United States have faced really since the early 20th century. It's a problem that labor parties in places like Britain and Australia and New Zealand have also had to deal with. So it's not even a uniquely American phenomenon.
So you've got Democrats at a disadvantage, even though They are in the big cities on both the East Coast, the West Coast, and parts of the Midwest. Something else is happening in the rural areas, and it's a different mindset as well as a difference in numbers. What's that mindset?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one of the things I'm trying to understand in my work is, you know, it's not the case that cities are, you know, 80% Democratic and rural districts are 80% Republican. It's actually the case that what we might think of as a rural district tends to be more heterogeneous than an urban district. We might think of cities as being very diverse. They're certainly more racially diverse and have a lot of different kinds of people. But it turns out that rural districts are more politically heterogeneous. It may seem counterintuitive, but when you build a rural district, it's often not just farms. There really aren't that many Americans employed in agriculture. It's a combination of small towns, medium-sized towns, many of which actually are majority Democratic, especially if they have any history of industry and labor unions, and especially if they had any migration from African Americans in the Great Migration, and certainly if they have a college or university. So you put all that together and you find even within a district that may look rural on the surface, they're actually quite heterogeneous. It's just that they're majority Republican.
What about gerrymandering? Many, many people have blamed Democrats' disadvantage on gerrymandering.
And I think there's a lot of truth to the basic observation that when we see in a place like North Carolina, we see the Democratic vote share and we see the seat share and we see that they're very different. It's very hard to explain that without gerrymandering. And that's absolutely the case. The thing I'm trying to add to that discussion is the importance of geography in even understanding how gerrymandering works. In some states, the job of drawing a gerrymandered redistricting plan is actually quite easy for one party. It's quite easy for the Republicans because of the concentration of Democrats in cities. There are other states, though, where that's actually not the case. There's a lot of variation across states. In some states, Democrats are much more spread out. A lot of states with newer cities that are more sprawling, like Phoenix, the Phoenix metro area is quite different in its political geography than some old cities like Philadelphia, where Democrats are much more concentrated. So the nature of the Democrats' problem really varies from one place to another.
So if it varies, how do you fix it?
Well, I think that it's a question that doesn't have a simple answer. So from the Democrats' perspective, there are states where gerrymandering is really their main problem. I think North Carolina might be a good example. So in those states, trying to do something about gerrymandering would be very beneficial to Democrats. But there are other states where even if we let kind of a nonpartisan computer algorithm draw lots of redistricting plans according to the rules that have been set out in the state, we see that there's still an advantage for the Republicans because the Democrats are so concentrated. So in those states, the answer to your question is a bit more complicated for the Democrats. They have to think about other kinds of reforms other than just simply to taking partisanship out of the redistricting process. Some Democrats will find it to their advantage to try to continue to keep partisanship as part of the redistricting process and try to draw districts that break up cities, for example. In some of the states, it's not very easy to draw up a redistricting plan that is fair to both parties without breaking up the cities. But then there are lots of people who will object to that for lots of reasons. So that brings us to another type of reform that people are increasingly interested in, which is something like proportional representation. And that's something that most European countries decided on early in the 20th century and have stuck with it since then.
Explain how that would work as opposed to what we have going on now.
So in the early part of the 20th century, it's interesting to note that all of the countries in Northern Europe had single-member district, winner-take-all systems, something more along the lines of the United States.
Yes.
And they all made a transition to proportional representation around the time of World War I. And so this is a kind of system where they're, instead of having a lot of small districts where there's just one winner from each district, they draw much larger districts that extend beyond the boundaries of just a single city. And then they elect many representatives, maybe 5, 6, 7, sometimes more. In the extreme case of the Netherlands, the entire country is one big district. And then they allocate the seats according to proportional representation of the party's vote shares. So each party gets a seat share that is the same as its vote share, essentially.
And does that make the political system work more fairly?
Well, many people would say that it does, because it takes away these big, what we call disproportionalities in turning votes to seats. It gives each party representation that comes closer to its actual vote share. But another thing that it does is I think it actually reduces this urban-rural polarization that I've been describing. It creates often a much more than a two-party system, sometimes depending on how proportional the system is. It produces 4, 5, maybe 6 political parties that put together different issues in different ways. And that means that we don't just have one extremely urban party and one ex-urban and rural party always kind of doing battle where geography is really central to that battle. That kind of gets reduced in a country with 5, 6 political parties.
That's really reaching, isn't it? When we hear people say over and over again, third party candidates get nowhere.
I mean, that's one of the things I think Americans don't fully appreciate is how unusual that is in the world to have this pure two-party system where there's just no entry of any other candidates at any level. That's quite rare. And when we look even just to the north and look at Canada, it has, even though it has also a system of winner-take-all districts, it still has entry of new parties, the Greens and the NDP, in addition to the Liberals and Conservatives, and has a lot of different parties competing in Quebec. We see similar things in Britain, in fact, where the party system is really going through an interesting transformation right now. So we're kind of the outliers on this dimension. Just to have these two parties in such a diverse country is quite unusual.
In your book, you talk about your belief that this whole urban-rural political divide began back in 1877 in Reading, Pennsylvania. Talk about what happened on that day.
Throughout the book, I use Pennsylvania as an example and kind of a narrative of how this story develops. And that was a time of labor unrest and strikes, kind of a wave of strikes throughout the United States. And this was a time well before the Democrats had become an ally of urban labor. And this is a moment when socialists were really organizing in some of the U.S. cities. And so Reading was kind of a hotspot of a socialist organization. And there was an alliance between labor and the socialists in some of these, especially some German cities. Milwaukee was another example. And it was at that moment, some of these places were starting to look much more like European cities, where socialists and social democratic parties started to succeed in the cities and started to build up relationships with labor. But in the United States, that never really went very far, never went much past places like Reading, in part because eventually the Democratic Party in the New Deal stole some of their thunder and really became the ally of labor unions. It took a long time for the unions to make that move to the Democrats, but it eventually happened.
So from then on, how did this urban-rural political divide develop?
Right. It's hard to tell a story about today's urban-rural divide that is purely based on labor unions and class and the economic divide when we look around at today's cities and we see that some of the very democratic cities are quite wealthy and don't have much of a history of union agitation. I mean, many do, but we can certainly see that there's more to the story than simply a legacy of industrialization and labor unions. And in fact, this correlation between population density and democratic voting really increased a lot since 1980, an era when class and income are becoming perhaps a bit less important in voting behavior. So I think the argument that I developed is that once a party develops an urban base, as the Democrats did in the industrial era, it then becomes kind of an attractive ally for other urban groups who are currently not really connected to a political party, and they're trying to push for their agenda. The Democrats become the rather natural place to go. And so this happened initially for urban African Americans after the Great Migration, even though the Democrats were still a party that was really associated with racial oppression in the South. The urban African American workers, as part of labor unions, also start to push Democratic representatives in the cities to adopt a civil rights agenda. And then they become, very slowly, eventually, become the party of civil rights. So that's just, I think, one of the first stories like this. And since then, we've seen several others. We've seen the rise of the social dimension and the rise of the abortion issue and other related issues where people's preferences are also very correlated with their geography. So people who have progressive views tend to live in cities, and people who have more conservative views tend to live in rural areas.
And why should that be?
I feel like that is one of the really interesting unanswered questions. I don't feel like I have a full answer to that question in the book. It's something that I think a lot of us are still really thinking about. The debate I think that many people are having who are thinking about this is, well, are cities different politically because moving to an urban environment shapes who you are? It changes your preference. If we could just take a person and plop them in a city, would they come to adopt a different set of preferences? Or do people who already have a certain view of the world pick up and move themselves to cities? Are we sorting ourselves out according to our ideas? The people who are more open to new experiences, do they gravitate towards cities? So I think there's probably something to the idea that we sort ourselves out in these ways. But I think there's also perhaps some bit of an influence that comes from living in a city. I think people learn to like things like public transportation. You know, there's a very, very different set of demands for public goods when you live in a city than when you live in a rural area. It might be easier to provide things like fire protection on a volunteer basis in a rural area, where in a city there's more need for government. So I think there are some reasons like that as well, that people develop different views.
Of course, great many younger people have been thronging into cities, but aren't we seeing a bit of the opposite happening as younger people move out into the suburban areas and really into the rural areas? Is that something that's making a difference as well?
I think it is slowly. I think that we should not think of migration and, you know, movement of people as something that just leads undoubtedly to more and more polarization and more segregation, because I think the trends recently have been a bit in the opposite direction. You know, there's a lot of discussion about the concentration of technology workers and college graduates in a set of superstar cities. But it turns out that it's very expensive to live in those cities, especially for a new college graduate. And a lot of the movement right now is to more sprawling and, as you describe, more suburban and even exurban environments. The places in the U.S., if we just look at the counties that are growing most rapidly, it's places like Phoenix, places like suburban Houston, or the area around Austin, places like Orlando. And that's a much different kind of environment. And one of the interesting things about those environments is that they are much more politically mixed, much more politically heterogeneous. We don't see the same intense concentration of people by partisanship in those new and growing cities. So that's definitely a possibility for the future, that as more cities grow like that, then we'll see less of this partisan segregation and concentration by population density.
And now a quick break. When I come back, more of my conversation with Jonathan Roden.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, the rest of my conversation with Jonathan Roden, professor of political science at Stanford University. His new book is titled Why Cities Lose: The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. I want to ask you about the Electoral College. And the complaint has been, certainly in that last election in 2016, that while one candidate, Hillary Clinton, received more than 3 million more votes than the winner, Donald Trump, it was the Electoral College that decided the election. Can you explain how this urban-rural political divide affects even that Electoral College?
Yes, anytime we take a group of voters and we chop them up into some kind of districts and we say, we're going to allocate something of value, a seat in the legislature or electoral votes, in a winner-take-all fashion based on these chunks, we will, in the event of a close election, potentially see this kind of disproportionality emerge, where the party that gets the most votes is not the same as the one that gets the most seats. So we're running that risk anytime we develop these districting strategies. You can think of this U.S. states as, you know, districts. And when we have one group that is more concentrated in this way, this is something that will occasionally emerge. I should add, there are certainly scenarios. One can look at future Electoral College scenarios and imagine outcomes where the opposite happens. It's not unimaginable. The Electoral College is a bit more unpredictable than the smaller units of congressional districts. So some have suggested that one way to get around the problem of the Electoral College is to use congressional districts as the units for allocating electoral votes. And one thing I think we can say with confidence is that that would actually be much worse for the Democrats than using the states as the unit of allocation.
And why is that?
Because Democrats are so concentrated in the cities. We can look at the congressional data. We can actually look at the presidential results at the level of precincts and aggregate those up to the congressional level. And we can look at, kind of hypothetically, what would happen. We can kind of rerun past elections using the congressional districts, and that we can see that it would be quite bad for the Democratic Party.
Let me understand whether you believe, as many do, that doing away with the Electoral College might create a more fair opportunity for the individual vote to count.
Yes, I think the Electoral College is just one of those rather old-fashioned institutions that, to me, doesn't have much of a purpose. It's hard to look around the world and find any other democracy that chooses a president with that kind of a scheme. Most places that have a president use some kind of a national popular vote or a two-round election system with a national popular vote. This kind of, you know, the use of districts to decide on a single office like that is rather unusual, and it's a bit hard to defend.
Does this urban-rural divide play out as dramatically as it seems to here in this country in other parts of the world?
Well, that's been one of the interesting trends in recent years. One of the things that's happened in this country, I think starting in the 80s, but really it's accelerated recently, is that globalization and the concentration of what we might call the global knowledge economy sector in big cities has emerged. And with the globalization and increasing trade, people working in manufacturing and some of the older industries on the outskirts of cities have really suffered as a result of the move toward global free trade. And as I describe this, these parties of the left become more associated with urban interest groups. We've seen a striking thing happen where the parties of the left have become more associated with globalization. And the reaction against globalization is something that's been taken up by parties of the right that have more of a rural base. So we've certainly seen that happen in the U.S., but we see something similar happening in a number of other places. Even going to some place like Hungary, if you look at the electoral map of Hungary, the parties of the left are highly concentrated in Budapest and a couple of other cities, and the party of the right that is in government gets all of its support from rural areas. We look at the Italian electoral map and we see something very similar. We look at British elections, we see something similar. So it's happening around the world. But again, I think having a two-party system makes it especially pronounced.
So if you could do one thing, if you could wave a wand that would make our elections somehow more fair to all parties and all people, what would be that one thing you would do?
Well, it's nice to think about magic wands when we don't have to. We don't have to worry about the actual practical questions like who would be opposed to this and what are the ways in which they would stop it. But I am fond of proportional representation. I understand that it has some downsides. There are lots of things that people might not like about coalition government, for instance. But when I compare it to some of the challenges we face, and I look at some of the challenges that other countries with single-member district systems face, like Canada and the UK, and I look at the way things have evolved in the UK in the wake of the Brexit referendum, I think proportional representation might be a better system for handling all of the changes associated with globalization and the changes in the party system. It might be a better way of emerging without such hostility, without such a high level of vitriol in the politics.
So short of changing our system to one of proportional representation, what do you feel Democrats need to do to somehow win back those areas of the country that they're now losing?
I've done a lot to try to understand the nature of the problem, and I don't see myself as an advisor of the political parties, but it does seem like they have a couple of options. You know, one of them is really something that they've done successfully for much of their history, which is, as I described earlier, they have to be many things to many people in order to succeed. And if they really just try to be one thing, it can make it difficult to win in some of these really heterogeneous environments where they need to win. So historically, the Democratic Party label has been rather diffuse, to say the least. There's an old Will Rogers joke that says, I'm not a member of an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. And that's been the secret to their success in the past, was to be rather heterogeneous. And it's probably something that, as a practical matter, they can't really escape, given the geography that they face.
What did they do in 2018 that was different from what they had done previously?
Yeah, that's a great question. That was quite an impressive wave election. It seems to have been a reaction to a highly unpopular president because the economy was doing very well. It's hard to know how to explain that large swing that was really present in a variety of different environments without viewing it as a reaction to what had been happening in the last 2 years. So the question then is, how much of that is kind of a permanent realignment? How much of that is a permanent change? Because a lot of what I describe in the Democrats' geographic problem has to do with their difficulties in suburbs. And obviously, they were very successful in a number of suburban districts.
Exactly.
In 2018.
Yeah.
They won an Oklahoma City district that was very surprising to many. They won a suburban Salt Lake City district. They were able to win in places where that were previously very difficult. So the question is, can they continue that? Was that a one-time development? Was that just a wave that eventually recedes? Or has there been some kind of a reaction in suburban areas that will prove to be permanent, kind of a realignment of suburban areas to the Democratic Party? I think it's way too early to draw any kind of conclusion like that. it is conceivable that this could be the beginning of that kind of a transformation. And if that was true, it would be bad news for the Republican Party, because it would undermine the geographic advantage that they've had for a number of decades now.
Jonathan Rodin, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Look for past podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urd-Livker. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you again on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.